I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'll speak to people who remind us to take better care of ourselves and people who will motivate us and inspire positive change. This podcast is made possible by Sally Hansen, the creator of which was an inspirational woman who promoted the message of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Whether it's a quick tan application or a cuticle oil top-up, Sally Hansen wants us to have the power to feel like our best selves. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I talk to Daniela Moyles. A couple of years ago, Daniela was doing it all. She was the anchor of a hugely popular breakfast show, modelling, DJing and working out. She looked like she had it all, but behind closed doors, things were falling apart. Daniela was suffering with chronic fatigue, skin problems, digestion problems, and she felt like she was at rock bottom. That's when she decided to honour her lifelong dream of going travelling. After years of running, it was finally time to stop. And when she stopped, she healed and evolved. I loved every second of this conversation, and I hope you do too. Daniela, thank you so much for joining me on The Good Glow.
It's lovely to be here, even though I'm absolutely petrified and it feels like another life since I had a microphone in my face like this, but I'll do my best.
It was so funny because obviously I've wanted to have you on the podcast for so long, and then a couple of weeks ago I just saw on your Instagram story you were in an airport and you put up a picture of your flight home to Dublin, and I was like, oh my god, she's coming home, I have to get her in.
2 years later.
2 years later, and so much has changed.
So much has changed. It feels almost like people say, oh, nothing changes when you go away. And maybe that's true when you're 21, but when you leave when you're 29, that's not true. Everything changes. I mean, obviously you're mid-career, you're obviously closer to probably being a homeowner or settling down when you leave at that age. So everything changes. Yeah, it feels like a different country. Even trying to like find the studio today, I was like, where's Harrington Street? Like, I don't remember the addresses. Or it's still familiar, of course, and still feels like home, but things do change, yeah.
The last time we really spent time together was when we both worked in Spin. You were the presenter of the breakfast show. Yeah. It was all very manic. We were all working really hard, and you were obviously on the busiest show of the day, getting up at the crack of dawn in straight away, have to turn that personality on. Like, you were exhausted by it by the end, weren't you?
Yeah. I don't think I ever adapted to sleeping properly, and that was probably my main problem. Like, I was really chronically fatigued, and I don't think I had a lot of respect for what that does to your lifestyle and your health. Like, I never stopped, and it wasn't just Spin, it was probably ingrained in me from being a model and from the constant feeling of scarcity and feeling like you needed to say yes to everything to earn a living. I mean, I never had you know, parents who gave me pocket money or any way that I felt like I had a buffer to fall back on. And so it was really ingrained in me from very young to take all the work and to always be busy. And that was a benchmark for success. So when I actually did become successful, I don't think I learned how to healthily say no and have boundaries to take care of myself at the end of a long day. I would do the breakfast show and then go and do a photo shoot and then go and do a DJ gig and then go and do the breakfast show. And I was so tired, just really, really tired. I think that was the main contributing factor that the breakfast show had on me not being at my optimum health. But
were you far down on your priority list, like work and doing this and going to that, and then you weren't kind of featuring very high up on your to-do list?
It's funny you say that, because I think if you'd asked me then, I would have said, of course, like, yeah, I go for pedicures, and I think about the shoes that I'm going to wear to this event that I need. Like, I'm really, my calendar is so planned and I have to-do lists, and I would have thought that I was looking after myself, but absolutely I didn't take care of myself at all. Again, I think it was just a feeling of needing to take every opportunity that came and not maybe taking on board what that means, or even what that means in terms of the direction that I wanted to go in. I'm not sure I even was doing things in a linear fashion. It was just yes, 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 yes. Of course, I'll be an ambassador for this. I'll sign myself up to this campaign. I'll do this job. I kind of always felt like I was pivoting for the next opening to step forward in my career blindly, if that makes sense. And so self-care didn't have much room in those days.
And you decided then that you were going to walk away from the radio job and that you wanted to go traveling for the summer. Was that a tough decision?
It wasn't that simple either. I'd always had a really strong love of travel, you know, just something that I was born with. It nearly felt like it was so innate. And when I was 21, I did a trip to Thailand, and I remember it being like the most profound experience. It really felt like something life-changing to me. I don't know how to put it correctly into words, but it was like the most alive I've ever felt. And I knew then that long-term travel was something that I had to do. It was not an option. But on that trip, I got really sick. I got so unlucky. I got a mosquito bite, and I got a tropical illness called dengue fever. And not everybody's heard of it. It's not as common as malaria, but there's also no vaccine and it's viral. So there's not a really straightforward treatment. They give you like big cocktails of antibiotics and it has three strains. So it's quite difficult to navigate around which strain you're dealing with. So I ended up in hospital for a month and I actually lost all of my hair from the strength of the medicine that they gave me.
Danielle, I completely forgot about that.
So I've actually been there with the no hair thing, and I can relate to how unbelievably jarring it is to your identity and to your just feeling good every day and feeling like yourself. You really feel like an alien in your own body. So I totally understand that. And since then, my like commitment to mermaid hair has been unshakable. Like I just won't even get a trim. I'm like, no, don't touch it.
Did it fall out in clumps? Did you shave your head?
I did shave my head, but it didn't fall out in clumps. It shed evenly all over, because the way it happened is your hair grows in stages. So there's like 3 months of growing, 3 months of being dormant, 3 months of shedding, if I'm getting a little bit of that wrong, and a hairdresser is saying like, you idiot, sorry. But mine shed. So when it went into the dormant stage, it stayed dormant basically. And so when it was meant to be growing, there was no growth, and then there was just too much shedding. So what happened was it was like an evenly thin hair all over my head. It wasn't clumps. And it got so, I was desperately trying to hold on to it, but it got so thin that I just had to shave it in the end. And I never was completely bald, like, you know, Gillette head, but it was like, you know, a one on a blade. And then I got a wig, but the wigs back then were just like, it was so hot. I remember because I was like 21 and I was going out and I was in college. I also got train track braces at the time. It was a really good time for my self-esteem. But I was trying to go out and I was trying to wear the wig, and like there's pictures of me, no joke, with my head out the windows of bars. Like I was just so hot all the time. Wigs are terrible.
They are. Well, I had to wear a wig last summer when it was the hottest summer like in history of Ireland. And I had a baby and I'd be running around the park in my wig. I'd just be like, this is just exhausting.
Yeah.
And I'd always wonder if people were looking at me and knew.
Yeah, you do always feel like it looks like it's not part of you. But now I see they have like things that where the hairline looks so natural, and I don't even know what it's called, but mine was like, I mean, there was like a blunt, and it was a really nice wig, but there was like a blunt line, you know, and there's just not a natural parting, and you know, well, it looks fake and it's like too big, and there's just a lot going on. I never felt comfortable in it. I bought the wig and I remember like being so upset about it. I like spent all of my savings. It was like £300 or something really expensive, and I had like a little savings at the time because I was just straight out of school, and I spent like all of my savings to get this wig, and then I was like, I can't even wear it. It was such a waste of money.
But that didn't turn you off the love of traveling?
No, it did. It really did. Yeah, and that's why it took me so long to go. And that's why it wasn't like so straightforward. I mean, because I always traveled, but I stayed around Europe and places where I felt like I couldn't contract something crazy. I wouldn't go near South America. I wouldn't go near Asia. I wouldn't go near Africa. I just stayed. And honestly, it took my body years to recover from that. It really did. I used to get recurring fevers. I could not put weight on. It was obviously amazing for my modeling career at the time. I went from being like a pretty kind of commercial blonde like photocall model to being this really thin, like shaved head catwalk model.
Wow.
Yeah. And it really did give me a much longer career. And, you know, that's a silver lining. What would have been maybe 4 years turned into a decade. But I think because I felt so limited in my ability to travel, I really focused on my career and started putting all my energy into that. Whereas if that hadn't happened with the dengue fever, I think I would have done long-term travel in my early 20s.
Okay.
And who knows what the experience would have been like then, or what it would have given me then, as opposed to what it gave me when I was older and had a little bit more, I don't know, probably awareness and less hangovers when I was doing it this time. But that's why I think it was so difficult ultimately to make that decision, and why I kept putting it off and putting it off. And just instead of doing travel, which was what I really wanted in my, you know, when people say to you, if you'd 1 year left to live, what would you do? I mean, that was my answer every time. It was just screaming from me that I wanted to do it, but I was scared. And so I would just keep focusing on my career, and my career kept growing legs because it was where I was putting my energy. And all of a sudden I'd gotten to this point where I was an anchor on a breakfast show, and I felt very, very privileged to be so. And I knew that it was a coveted position that if I left would be gone immediately. It's not like I could take a sabbatical or something like that. And so the choice to go in the end wasn't really so voluntary, but more like necessary and forced. And travel ended up being the thing that I fell back on to kind of bring me back, if that makes sense.
And how do you feel when you're going traveling? Like, do you feel scared that you're so alone?
Honestly, no. And I know that that is a really like common question that people ask when they're, am I going traveling on my own? Am I going to make friends? Is it scary? But I think, again, it was probably a combination of two things. My innate love of it. And also, I was more scared of staying at home at that time, to be honest. Travel felt like a safety blanket and like a quick bypass exit door where I could just find my way out of what I'd gotten myself into. And so, no. And maybe my circumstance is unique in that way, and that other people who are planning to travel and really putting the time and effort and work into planning it, it can feel overwhelming when you're looking at it, you know, from that kind of macro scale. It's not scary. The world is wonderful. And it really, I can't even put into words yet what that 2 years has given me.
So were you going to get headspace to try to relax, to just get away from the kind of madness of just, because I suppose when you're here and you're in it and you're working, like, time is just going so fast and you're just kind of on this roller coaster.
Yeah, at home definitely felt like a roller coaster. That's a really good word to use it. And I felt like a roller coaster. I was all over the place in every sense of the word. And that's funny to say because it's contradictory to how it looked. It was probably the most together that my life's ever been. And now that I'm home, I look back at that time and I'm so impressed by how prosperous I was in Dublin. After living in Indonesia for 5 months, I can tell you I'm impressed by anyone who's prosperous in Dublin. It's such an expensive, fast-paced city. And even though I haven't been gone that long, I've been living a very slow and steady life. And so I'm quite impressed by how together I was at that time, you know, renting in Dublin with the job I had and the car I had and the life I had. But it was so funny on the inside. I just did not feel any, I had not an ounce of appreciation for that, first of all, because it was just, as I said, it's what you grow up in. It's all you know. That's the benchmark of success. And so you have to get there, and you don't give yourself any credit when you do, because it's what everyone's doing. But inside I felt like completely the opposite of that. I was just erratic in every sense of the word. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't thinking straight. I wasn't emoting straight. I got to a point where, and it was slow, really, really slow and steady. And I was completely oblivious. I should be clear about that. It's not like I knew this was happening inside of me and I was ignoring it. I was just ignoring it because I didn't know it was there. It started like a little whisper, just, I suppose what it is would be like the overspilling of stress and the symptoms that people have when they're stressed. Lack of sleep, you know, digestion problems was a big one. Skin problems was a big one. And I was always trying to rectify the symptom rather than understanding the bigger picture. But that had been the story of my life growing up. I think I now have the clarity of hindsight to look back and see how I was probably predisposed to being inclined to worry and be stressed. And it's only after stopping and taking those years to introspect and get to know myself that I understand this. But at this time, I was completely ignorant to any predisposition I might have had from my childhood or any stresses I might have carried from my childhood or any stresses in my life at that time. I was just, as I said, blindly concerned with ambitious progress in my career. And by the time I left Spin, I was really at a place where I could hardly like get out of bed. Even though I was doing a breakfast show in the morning, I would expend every ounce of my energy on those 3-4 hours in the day. But it was slowly becoming apparent. Like, my co-host Cormac used to call me Brenda Fricker because I used to dress like the homeless woman out of even Home Alone. Mm-hmm. So it was, and it's interesting for me now being home, like, from your perspective, like, what was I like in the office? I can't even imagine.
I don't know. Like, I kind of feel like you were very much, you were kind of like a machine. So you'd come in, and you'd do your job, and then you always had somewhere else to be,
yeah.
You know, an exercise class to go to. Like, you were very hard on yourself, I think, as well. Like, you were kind of, it's hard for me. Like, we weren't best friends.
No.
Because you were very much,
we worked different shifts, kind of. We overlapped, yeah, a little.
But you were just, you were doing your own thing. You were just trying to keep your world going, I think, and you weren't as involved as maybe the rest of us, and that's not a bad thing.
No, and I totally felt that. And it's so funny now that, because when I heard that you got sick when I was away, and when I went away in general, I feel like maybe a machine is a good word to use, but I always called it like a shell. And it's funny that you identified it that way. It was like something cracked open in me, and I think I was always, yeah, just in a shell. And I don't know whether that was protecting myself or whether that was just trying to cope with the amount of things going on in the day or whatever else. But like, my heart literally broke when I found out that you were sick. One, because my mum got breast cancer at 35. So I'm so aware of what that means in a first world sense. Sorry, not in a first world. I mean, in a first hand sense, as like living with her and watching her go through that. And I felt just so bad that I'd never in person, like, I don't know, said to you like the things that I wish I could have said to you then, if that makes,
yeah,
sense. Like, you know, I hope you're well, or how are you today? Like, I don't think I asked people that in the office. I was just like in and out, and, you know, I would never sit down with you and be like, do you want to get a tea, or how's Pia today? Or, you know, I didn't have those conversations, and all those things hit me when I left, like a tsunami, like how much I had been living wrong, basically.
Because I was so shocked at how, like, I got a lot of messages from people being like, hey, heard you're sick, hope you're okay. But the messages from you kept coming, the support kept coming. But like, I was surprised, you know, and it was really nice, to be honest. It was lovely that you kept checking in with me. And I suppose I got to know the real you over the last 2 years, even though I didn't ever see you. It was all online.
Yeah.
But through messages, I suppose, I got to see the real you. And you're amazing.
Thanks. As are you, like, which is like so clear to see from the success of this podcast and everyone that talks about it and the interest in you now and how you're doing. And it's also incredibly inspiring. And even, as I said, just seeing my mum go through it and seeing you today and how well you look and how like glowing you are and your hair looks so long. And like, it's amazing. It really is. And I don't know how I would ever cope with something like that happening directly to me, and with managing the fear then moving forward in your life and trying to be happy and not be scared. So I think it's incredibly impressive. And I think I found in myself over the last 2 years that I'm a much softer person than I ever like let myself be. And I think part of not being soft before was, there was a million different things that would take me a million hours to explain to you, but it just became how I functioned inside of this shell.
And how did those changes take place? Like, what country were you in? Where did you go?
it was probably already slowly taking place before I left. And let me just be clear, I deserve no credit for this. Like, it's not like I electively took a long, hard look at myself and was like, God, I really need to make some changes and slow down and maybe be a little bit softer or be a little bit more myself, because it's really hard living this, like, overly competent, overly confident, overly productive life that I'm not actually made for. It was forced on me. You know, when you hear that thing of like, change happens when the pain of staying the same is worse, or something mm-hmm. like that. That's ad-libbed, but that's really why. It wasn't that I was smart enough or wise enough to know better. It was that it got to a point where I was looking at the prescription for antidepressants and a fetal position in my mum's house as my option, or I go and do this thing that's been calling out of me for years at the most counterintuitive time, but I listen to my gut and trust myself and take that risk, and I can always come back and go on the prescription. And there's nothing wrong with prescription. It's necessary for some people, but I knew in my heart and in my gut that it wasn't what mm-hmm. I needed at that time, mm-hmm. and that actually what was wrong with me wasn't medical. It was personal. It was lifestyle. It was repeated patterns of behaviors over a really long time. It was conditioning. And I knew that there was someone else in me, if that makes sense, that was trying to get out, you know. So
you were funny. No, it's amazing. It's like your honesty is amazing, Daniela. Yes. Did your mum encourage you to go, or did she want you to stay?
I'm sure my mum and dad and my brother and everyone who cared about me were really, really concerned about me going. As I said, it wasn't the time. Like, who goes traveling the world when on a normal day they can barely not have a panic attack, or they can barely get out of bed or be forced into the shower? I mean, I was so low on like energy, and I had just gotten to such a bad place in my head. I felt like I was funny. I saw this YouTube video the other day that was of the deepest swimming pool in the world, and it was like the most relatable metaphor. So it's for free divers, and they can go down and down and down, like 40 meters into this tiny hole inside of a swimming pool. And at the bottom, there's like a tiny spot of light at the top. And that is how I felt at that time. I felt, and I'm so scared of water as well, so it really was the perfect metaphor, because I felt like I was drowning in the thing I'm most scared of at the bottom of this deep black hole, and I could not figure out how to get out.
But that's, you could see the light.
I could see it. I could definitely see it. And that's why that was so powerful to me when I saw it on YouTube. I was like, that's what I felt like. And there was days where I would wake up and be like, I know for sure I will never be myself again. And I would be like, I would have conviction in saying that. So I'd be like, I'm too far gone. I'm gone. I can feel it. I'm gone. But there was just this little seed of instinct telling me that where I would reconnect with who I was and where I would figure it out and where I would get time and space is if I took these years to travel. And I didn't have any plan, and I didn't have a route. I didn't have a time scale. I just had, thankfully, very privileged savings in the bank, which I probably should have used wiser and bought myself a house or something more responsible. But it was within a week the decision was made. I just went, and my parents were thankfully very, very supportive and very overbearing with checking in, but very supportive.
Because you're so close to your mum.
Yeah, she's like my number one on the planet, but she's like my sister, my best friend, my idol. Yeah,
that's so. One thing that we always did have in common was that we were both so close
and
to
your
our mums.
So beautiful.
And so is your mum.
I remember me at your wedding and be like, my God, your mum is so beautiful. Like, it's funny, isn't it, that I was at your wedding and like we've worked together over all these years, but yet we managed to never really get, like, that blows my mind now. Mm-hmm. That blows my mind now. Like, as I said, it all feels like a different life. It's like, how did that happen? How did I spend so much time in your proximity and we're so alike and you're so warm and I think I'm warm under, like, how did we never?
I don't know. I feel like neither of us were being our true selves. Maybe so, like, not. Do you know what I mean? Like, we were both, it was a different time.
I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I definitely feel like I cracked open a part of myself that I just was never in touch with. And maybe it was a part of me that I did get in touch with when I went home to Nace, or when I was around my school friends who I've had since I was, you know, teenager. And when I went traveling, I realized those things, like how rich I am in the areas that I just never paid attention to, like my group of friends, how absolutely unbelievably lucky I am to have those girls, and the support that we have for each other, the love that we have for each other, the length of our friendships, the number of us that have stayed together from school, and like my family and how amazing they are. And those are things, again, that I just blindly thought that everybody has. And, you know, this is just how it is for people, instead of being truly aware and grateful for it every day. So, yeah, I think I was just living a little bit blindly.
And you've spoken about, you know, cracked open, and you know, you were able to kind of dig deeper. Did that happen in Mexico?
No. So for the first year, I was constantly on the move. There was like a huge amount of running being done. Let me just make it clear again that I didn't go and have some profound, you know, moment where I stepped off the plane in some jungle being like, well, now I know myself. No, like there was, I started in Alaska and I traveled down the California coast of the States, and then I did all of Central and South America, and then I did Asia. I did 8 months in Central and South America, and I can tell you I had maybe a handful of moments where I could feel myself opening up or remembering something or thinking about something that I didn't want to think about, or sitting quietly with myself. And those moments were forced. They were the 18-hour bus journeys. They were the long flights. They were the waiting room, whatever. Because I was filling my days the same way I did when I worked in Spin. It's not like I went and changed. I didn't change at all. I couldn't sit with myself. No way. I couldn't be on my own with my thoughts. I couldn't face thinking about whatever it was that had gotten me to the point where I essentially had a breakdown, and I essentially had, you know, a panic disorder by the time I left Spin. And I didn't want to face those things at all. So there was 8 months of a huge amount of drugs as well, just to be completely honest about it. I just was numbing in every way possible. I mean, there was so much drugs that I was starting to miss flights that were really expensive that I couldn't afford to miss. And I was like, that was the thing that was like, I need to stop this now. Mm-hmm. Like I'm missing, I was so high, I couldn't go to an airport, I'd get arrested. Like there was no way.
And what sort of like drugs were they?
I mean, happy ones.
Okay.
Ones that make you happy. I was like, yeah, just anything that would, you know, afford me a false sense of serotonin for a period of time. But I mean, that runs out as well. It's not like you've got an endless, you have to rebuild that stuff. Mm. And it's not like when I was coming down, I was particularly in a good headspace to rebuild it. So there was like a lot of months of that.
And is that like a numbing thing?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, it's, you're not, again, none of that. This is all the clarity of hindsight. Mm-hmm. When you're in it, it's not that clear. You're not going, okay, today I'm going to numb myself.
Yeah.
You're just like, you wake up and it's like, I'm alone. I'm in Costa Rica. You know, I'm in a dorm room with two smelly boys and a 24-year-old from, I don't know, California. Like, what am I doing? Like, I've left my job, my career's, you know, I don't know, in the past now. And there's just a sense of like, there's only so much time you can spend reading. And don't get me wrong, I've never actually had a more like grateful, like light bulb moment than when I realized how much I never read before I went traveling. Like that was one of the best things it gave me as well. It was just a moment to stop and read. And reading was actually the first thing that was calming to me, or would make me sit down or make me think. But also there's only so much of that you can do when you're on your own and you're traveling, and filling your days with every attraction, every must-do list, every hiking trail, every restaurant that you need to visit. Like I would do that every day. My days were packed. It's not like I was being very self-aware from the get-go. Mm-hmm. There was a huge amount of pivoting and trying my best to escape the reality of it all. But I did, it's probably not surprising, feel enormously less stressed, as you might imagine when you just stop doing everything and just leave the real life, you know, that you were living. And that was a relief in itself and enough to keep me going at the start.
So after Mexico, how long did you stay in Mexico for then?
So Mexico wasn't actually in the first year that I was traveling. Okay. It was a stop for sure. I think I was there for maybe 2 weeks, but I kept going for the first year of backpacking and I never stayed anywhere for too long. I came home for a little while after the first year. I did like literally a full year to the day.
Okay.
And I came home for one of my best friend's weddings. I stayed home for a few weeks. And then
Tempted to stay at this
not
point?
At all. Not at all. Oh my God. The thought of coming home was so much scarier than the thought of keeping going. Like no way I wasn't ready in any sense of the word. There was so much. I mean, I had just left in a whirlwind. There was so much loose ends here that I hadn't faced. Like, at all. I hadn't explained to people the things that had happened. I hadn't acknowledged that I'd left my job or thought about what I was going to do when I came home. Or like, I mean, no, even trying to like buy a car, I was like, I couldn't, I can't do this. I have to keep going. So yeah, I moved to Mexico then for 3 months. And from Mexico, I moved to Indonesia for 5 months. And then I came home. So that was pretty much the 2 years summarized. But it wasn't in Mexico that I think I had time to reflect. When I was running and running for those 8 months in Central South America, as you can imagine, I just got exhausted. Like I was going to see these incredible sites and I would have this moment where I'd go, I don't even care. And that's when I knew, I was like, if you can be here, like, I don't know, on the salt flats in Bolivia, when people are in an office in Dublin and when you used to crave this with every cell of your body and feel in any way indifferent or tired or like you're not just completely in awe, then you need another break because you need a break from the break. You're not doing something right. But as I said, it just wasn't that straightforward. It's not like I left and figured it out. I was still an idiot. Like I still didn't know myself. I still had no idea. I was just blindly doing the things, and that's always kind of how I've operated, and I don't know if that's right or wrong, but I don't think it's changing. I've always been a very unconventional, somewhat fearless, risk-taking, intuitively driven, novelty-driven person, and I have to accept that and know it and also know how to manage it. So at that time I was just doing the things that my gut told me, but I did realize that there had come a saturation point with novelty and that I needed to really sit down. And so I signed myself up to yoga teacher training in Thailand, and that was really the moment I figured some stuff out.
So that was the start of you kind of healing?
It was like a slow breakdown, right? You know, so I like left and was not in a good headspace and got fed up of the drugs and got fed up of the sights and realized I was just so exhausted. Like I went to meet a friend, this sounds so casual, I'm like, I went to meet a friend in Japan when I was flying from Brazil. So once I ticked off all of South America, I was going to Asia. My first stop was Japan because it's the closest stop when you're flying over the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And lots of my friends came out to meet me as I was traveling, and that was amazing. And I was meeting a friend in Japan whose mother had just passed away, and the friend is so dear to me and so special, and I wanted so much to show up for that person when they needed me with all the energy and all the positivity and all of the effort that I could put in. And it was just under 2 weeks of us being together, and I loved the time so much, but it only made clearer to me how tired I was and how much I was struggling to show up for this friend. So by the time I got to Thailand, I was like just done. And everyone was like, well, did you always want to be a yoga teacher? And I'm like, no, I just had to sit down and stop. And that's what that gave me.
So something was calling you to do this?
Well, not so much the yoga teacher training, but more just sitting down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you eventually did it after?
It was 8 months later.
Okay.
Yeah. 8 months later, I signed up for the yoga teacher training. I've always loved yoga. Actually, that's a lie. Let me be honest. I hated yoga. I used to get so angry and like really didn't enjoy it. Before I got kind of sick with that headspace, like physically sick from being in that headspace, I did yoga and I didn't get it. I just thought it was boring. I didn't need it. I was like, what's this all about? It's so hullabaloo. And I just thought it was, yeah, I didn't get it. Once I got sick from stress or lifestyle, people say to you, do yoga. I mean, that's what everybody says. They're like, do yoga. Oh my God, it's life changing. No. I used to go in and be so angry. And now I think I understand it's because yoga makes you move in ways that are uncomfortable, and being uncomfortable brings up uncomfortable emotions, or can bring up anger because you're uncomfortable, or mm-hmm. sadness because you're uncomfortable. And so the things that were inside me dying to get out, that I would keep so capped with this shell, came out when I was doing yoga. But I didn't understand that at the time. I would just be like, that thing makes me so angry. And I mean, like, I would be angry in a way that I've never felt, that I didn't think I was capable of. I'd nearly have to storm out of the class. Or there'd be other times where I'd go, God, vinyasa is so challenging, I'll just do a relaxing yin class. And instead of getting angry, I'd bawl my eyes out. And I'd be like, yoga's not for me. I'm just an insane person when I do it. So it's kind of ironic that the thing that called me or whatever was yoga teacher training. But I think I knew that I needed to understand why I was feeling like that when I would do yoga. And I really did. It was really confronting and really difficult. And that sounds like such a first world problem for people who are actually going through something difficult. But I just had never tried to put a lasso on my emotions, or to try and self-reflect, or to try and really get to know myself. And I, that was the first time when I sat quietly and I couldn't fidget or run or take something or be busy.
And that, were they the changes that you started to see in yourself, that you were able to do that? Like, you were able to sit down and...
I think it was, yeah, that was definitely a change, that I was able to do that. I've always been so flighty and busy and very, very proud to be so. And so it was new to sit so still, or to... And it was, again, forced, you know. It wasn't me going and sitting out by the beach and meditating for 45 minutes. It was like, okay, I've spent thousands on this retreat, I need to step up now and pay attention when they say to meditate, or, you know, take part in the classes where they're talking about emotion, or, you know, really stick in this pretty intense 3 hour 6 a.m. sunrise morning flow. Which was, I mean, I was not ready to be a yoga teacher. It's not like I went in there being like, oh yeah, I can do the crow. I couldn't do anything. So it was really challenging for me. And overcoming all of those little hurdles in terms of the actual physical sense of doing the course was a gateway into me just sitting with my thoughts. And it's hard yet to fully articulate like how that changed me. But and again, if you'd asked me before, like, can you sit with yourself, or do you know yourself? I would have said, of course. But you don't realize until you really step away from the world that you've always known, and the routine that you've always known, and the familiarity that you've always known, and the security that you've always known, how much that's not necessarily true. Like, I did not know myself, and I could not sit with myself.
Wow. And did you enjoy that then? Did you enjoy getting to know, like, the real you?
No. It was terrible. Honestly, it was awful, because you have to face all your shit parts.
Yeah.
You have to look at yourself and go, I really fucked up there. I really hurt that person. I really fell short there. I could really do it working on that. This is a part of myself I just don't, like, admire.
So you were acknowledging all of these things that you'd been putting off for so long.
It was like a tsunami of, you're the worst person in the world. Oh. And that's not necessarily true, but it was necessary to think about. It was necessary to learn all the ways that I had not been compassionate, not been thoughtful, not been supportive, not been kind, not been present, not been a million different things. And we all have our flaws, but I had never taken a look at mine. Never. Like, never.
And did that help you to move on then? Yes. By acknowledging all of these things?
Yes, definitely. I mean, firstly, I felt like I understood myself better, and I liked myself better, and I forgave myself. Mm. And I did what I needed to do to fix the things I could. It's not like I went around, like, hurting everybody.
Yeah,
it's not that.
Of course.
It's just that you can be blind to your own shortcomings. And I was certainly blind to mine. Not entirely blind. I think you always do know. You mm-hmm. always do know, you just choose to ignore.
Yeah.
It's there, and it's there in your subconscious or in the back of your mind, or like a whisper. And then, as I said, you're just busy and you just get on with your day. And you'll deal with that deficit some other time, because right now you've got a calendar of stuff to do.
So. And did you feel physically better at that time?
Oh, so much. And even things like my skin got so much better. Like, I had suffered from chronic digestion problems and I could never figure it out. And it was so elusive to me. And all these treatments were also ineffective. You know, I would be like taking intolerance tests. I would be taking every supplement here and there. I would be like trying so desperately to deal with the individual symptoms of what ultimately ended up being a mind-body connection problem. And where the actual stem of it all was just a complete discontentment in my own mind that manifested in so many different discontentments in my body that I think ultimately would have made me really sick if I hadn't acknowledged or understood on a bigger scale what was happening and just had kept trying to individually deal with the symptoms of a bigger problem. But again, that's hindsight.
And what did a typical day look like for you at this time? Like, what did you do?
Went in the yoga course. Yes. We would do this like 3-hour, very intense sunrise vinyasa flow. And then we would have a small break and get some breakfast. And it was all plant-based food, which was amazing. I really enjoyed it. And then we would do 3 hours of lectures. It could be on yoga philosophy or anatomy. And then we would have a small break and then another couple of hours, which was generally like a mind class. So you do something about emotion or you would do a long meditation and then you would do another flow and then bed. So I've never had more pain in my body and more peace in my head, to be honest, but it was really necessary. And I'm not a yoga teacher now, but I'm very grateful to what that practice gave me at that time. I would never try and paint everyone's situation with the same brush and be like, oh, you need to go traveling and do yoga teacher training to figure it all out. But it was what really helped me. And it just allowed me to sit with myself and to have some time with my own thoughts and to also move my body in a way that allowed me to maybe release that out of me then.
Yeah.
You know?
And so would you consider that time then life changing?
Absolutely. The 2 years, everything about it, everything was necessary.
Yeah.
The getting to the bottom was necessary to get out, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I would never have figured it out had it not been forced on me. I dread to think of that reality. Like, I dread to think of myself still being just staying afloat, barely aware of who I am, barely aware of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, but conventionally successful and pleasing everybody else's idea of what it is to be having a good day or having a good week or a good year. Oh, you got your promotion. Oh, you've got a new car from golf. Oh, from Volkswagen. Oh, you've got this event on or that event on. No, like, I don't want any of that now anymore. It's not on my priority list at all. It's my whole perspective of what it is to have a good day is different.
And it's that thing that, like, I think lots of people put off. It's like it has to get worse before it gets better. And lots of people are so afraid to go to that bad place, even though you know that you have to face that to come out the other side and be free of just the stuff that you carry around sometimes from day to day.
Everybody's worst experiences are a doorway to their biggest growth. I'm sure your cancer experience has been profoundly eye-opening and has changed everything about the way that you live and the way that you see the world and the way that your mindset is. Like, yours was so much more scary, but everybody's experience is equally scary to them. It's a perspective thing. So to go to somewhere where it's uncomfortable and where you feel scared or where things feel like they're falling apart, I was in there and I know what it feels like to feel like you can't get out, but that's not true at all. It really is, even if you can't see it now, something you look back on and say, I'd never change that. And that's so weird.
It's so weird.
Because at the time you're like, I would do anything to change this.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't change a minute of all of that time.
And isn't that an amazing thing that you can say? Yeah. How did you reach the decision then to come home?
I felt like I was running. If I'm being honest, because the thought of coming home was so scary. Like, it's easy for me to be stress-free and happy on the beach. It's easy for me to live in Indonesia where your rent is €250 a month and I can drive a scooter for €140 a day and I can kind of live in, you know, Peter Pan, La La Land. But everyone I love and everything I am is here. And as I said, I think I realized the richness, the real richness, the real essence of a good life is in my family and my friends. And I love Ireland so much, and Ireland's always been so good to me. And it's weird to come home now because it's starting over, and it's really scary. It's really scary. Like, it's another step in the challenge. Do you know what? I keep waiting for the day where I'm going to feel so bad, because everyone's like, God, you really get the blues. And I really don't. And I do think that that's down to really learning a new mindset and being very grateful. Like, I have gratitude tattooed on my arm, and every evening I have a little just book beside my bed. I write three things I'm grateful for in it, and it sounds so simple, but like, we have a negativity bias as human beings for survival, for evolution. Our body is wired to potently remember the bad, be it your emotional pain or your physical pain or the things that scare you in the day. And that's not relevant nowadays, because we're not part of the food chain. We're not being chased by lions. We don't have to potently remember the bad quite as much to survive a day. And so it's up to us to actively rewire our neural circuitry. And one of the really simple ways you can do that is just by practicing gratitude. And it sounds so simple, but often the biggest changes are in the simplest things. And so I haven't had this moment where I'm like, oh my God, I'm home and the world is caving in, because I really do notice all of the tiniest things, and they make me so happy now.
Daniela, you're amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I could literally sit here and listen to you all day talk about this.
And vice versa, even though I never shut up there. But I feel like, now that we have the mics off, can we have a proper conversation about how you are, not just all about me?
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, made possible by Sally Hansen. To discover more, you can shop the products in Macaulay Health and Beauty Pharmacies and other stores across the country now. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe so you can be the first to hear about new ones. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. To all my listeners in Ireland and those of you around the world, thank you for the amazing support and continued feedback. You can find out more about my story on thegoodglow.ie and follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford.